case is Serrani against Beverly Healthcare. Ms. Hearn.
May it please the Court. My name is Anna Hearn, and I represent Victoria Serrani. The definition of the Pregnancy Discrimination Act states that women affected by pregnancy, childbirth, or related medical conditions, which is very important in this case, shall be treated the same for all employment-related purposes as other persons not so affected, but similar in their ability or inability to work. The purpose of the Pregnancy Discrimination Act was to cover up any blind spots that were not covered under Title VII previously. Here we have Beverly Healthcare admitting to treating one class of its employees better than its pregnant employees. And that in itself is a facial violation of the law. Its policy.
Where was that, Ms. Hearn?
What?
Where was that? Where do they admitted they treated?
There are individuals who were with on-the-job injuries were received accommodations. However, women as pregnant women.
That policy doesn't have anything to do with pregnancy. Please don't touch the microphone.
I'm sorry.
The policy doesn't have anything to do with pregnancy. Suppose an employee falls off a ladder at home and hurts her back and as a result can't do the same things your client couldn't do. What would Beverly's policy be? I take it there would be no accommodation for that employee.
Well, if you look at the policy itself, that would be the case. However, there were also other evidences that they were not, in this case, at this facility, applying that policy across the board. But that
I understand, but if at least I understand your contention. But if you're trying to figure out what their policy seems to be that if an employee acquires some condition off the job that prevents the employee from doing all of the necessary tasks, there won't be any accommodation if that problem is temporary. And that appears to be your client's problem. Your client had a temporary condition that prevented her from doing all of the job's tasks.
However, if you read the statute, the pregnancy discrimination, there's no exclusion in the act that states if an employer can treat individuals who were injured on the job differently than other people, such as people who have disabilities or people who are pregnant. There is no exclusion in that statute that states it, and if you read the statute in itself, I think the statute is clear regarding
But the PDA doesn't require preferential treatment for pregnant.
Excuse me?
The PDA doesn't require preferential treatment for pregnant employees.
They don't require, but they require similar treatment. It says, but similar in their ability, shall be treated the same. So if a person having an on-the-job injury gets an accommodation, that pregnant woman who possibly needs a restriction.
But under the PDA, can't they have a policy like that?
They do not have a policy like that. Beverly never had a policy that would afford any type of accommodation to a pregnant woman. And
no,
that,
I'm saying they have a policy with individuals who are injured on the job.
Correct.
Can't they have that policy and still be in compliance with the PDA?
I do not think they can. Because if you read the statute and the construction of the statute, it says they shall be treated the same, but similar in their ability or inability to work. You are taking two classes.
That's your problem. With respect to anybody who acquires an off-the-job condition, your client is being treated similarly to those people, right? What you're arguing is that under the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, amendment to Title VII, the comparison group is some kind of most favored nation, if there's anyone for any reason who gets an accommodation, then pregnant employees are entitled to an accommodation.
So would disabled employees. And that's why we have the Americans with Disabilities Act. What the district court held was that there was a blind spot, that Congress intended to create a blind spot for individuals like Victoria.
By definition, no one intends blind spots. And the point here is that the Pregnancy Discrimination Act is not an accommodation statute. It's an equal treatment statute.
Correct.
The accommodation statute is the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Which it is also.
You might fare better by making your accommodation argument under the actual accommodation requiring statute.
Which I will in the argument. There's two, because she had severe medical conditions, shearing of the uterus, a prior miscarriage just weeks before her current pregnancy. She had spotting, cramping, was on bed rest. And even Judge Miller agreed that she had a severe impairment under the ADA, and that we look at Bragdon versus Abbott, who says childbearing and reproduction are major life activities pursuant to the Americans with Disabilities Act. However, then the district court went one step further and said, well, pregnancy is a temporary condition, so she's not disabled under the ADA. Well, there are that would go against the holding in Bragdon versus Abbott, when the U.S. Supreme Court said childbearing is a major life activity.
You're losing me. Your client's ability to bear children has not been impaired, nor is that the ground on which there was an adverse decision by the employer. Right? The argument that was made in this case and accepted by the district court is that your client's lifting ability and similar physical abilities were impaired temporarily. And the district court relied on our opinion in Wagoner and the EEOC's regulation at 29 CFR 1630.2. And I think it would help us if you would address Wagoner and the regulation.
With respect to, personally, I believe the court overlooked and didn't address childbearing as a major life activity, which it is, because if she did not follow her doctor's restriction, the lifting restriction, which was not even in the job description, she was the activities director here, not like a CNA in Spivey who had a lifting restriction. We are looking at something that was not in her job restriction. If she did not adhere to her doctor's orders of light duty and not...
I'm trying to do you a favor. And the district court's principal authority for ruling against you was our decision in Wagoner. Your opening brief doesn't mention Wagoner. Your reply brief doesn't mention Wagoner. When you just don't mention the principal appellate authority against you, you're in trouble. I'm giving you an opportunity to discuss Wagoner.
I could take a second and look at the opinion in Wagoner, Your Honor, or maybe I could do that on rebuttal. I would be more than happy to.
Where is the long-term impact here on your client?
The long-term impact?
Yeah. I mean, she was able to have a child.
She did.
Subsequent. No complications.
She did.
Nothing. Where is the long-term impact here?
She was fired. She was fired while she was pregnant, while she was on restrictions. She had complications. There's many courts throughout the nation that says that women who have physiological disorders, such as my client, have a severe impairment with respect to their disability, and they are afforded protections under the ADA. And not only that, is that how they treated other individuals, you know, who were not pregnant or who...
So you're saying the long-term impact here refers to her being fired?
Well, any woman who's pregnant who's suffering complications, that condition goes away once you have birth. I mean, there are courts throughout the Seventh Circuit that have throughout the nation, including Bragdon versus Abbott, that have held that pregnancy, childbearing is a major life function.
It was found that there was an impairment here,
Correct.
What is the long-term impact from the impairment?
That, well, at that time, she had a miscarriage. They were thinking she was going to lose another child. So the impairment was her not being able to go full term with this child and lose another child.
That could be short term, but I think, as we all know, she had a child after this.
After she
pregnancy.
Was fired,
after
yes.
Pregnancy.
Right, she did. And which is wonderful. She did.
I agree.
But we have to also look at the facts with respect to the discrimination, not just the policy. If this court accepts the policy as valid under the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, they did treat other individuals who did not have on-the-job injuries differently. For example, she, prior to her pregnancy, was receiving the same assistance that she requested afterwards. She was not, as an activities director, her duties were to play, organize bingo. She was to have the priest come in and do church services. And that was her duties. It was not to lift patients. In fact, she was prohibited from doing so. So if she had to transport a patient, they would have the CNAs do that. That was their job duty. Or some of the assistants, physical therapy assistants. And everyone helped, even the head director, Don Mount, who used to be an activity director prior to that. So everyone helped her prior to her pregnancy. But as soon as she got her formal restrictions and gave it to her employer, they fired her. Now, other activities director, Don Mount, received the very same assistance. She never had an on-the-job injury. The current activity director, her name's Heather, never had an on-the-job injury. They were receiving the same assistance that Victoria received, that she requested by her doctor's restrictions. And she was fired for asking for that very same assistance. Victoria could be a similarly situated person prior to her pregnancy, since she was given the same assistance. She never had an on-the-job injury. Now, other individuals, you know, with respect to credibility determinations, other individuals, an older lady by the name of Bonnie, didn't have an on-the-job injury. She wasn't feeling well, so people would do double time it and assist Bonnie with her duties. With respect to whether the accommodation was reasonable, it was reasonable. So they were giving her the same assistance prior to it. Additionally, the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, with respect to the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, she had paid time left. They fired her prior to her expiring her time. The HR director testified she still had paid time left. And instead, they fired her. I would probably like to, with respect to retaliation, they began writing her up after she asked for an accommodation. They kept changing, they changed the reasons from her quitting to being terminated. That goes to pretext. So I would probably like to hold the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Mr. Glassman.
Good morning, Your Honors. I am Michael Glassman on behalf of the Appalee Beverly. And I think the issues in this case are clear-cut. The circuits that have addressed this are uniform in agreeing with the result of Judge Miller. And I think in this case, the PDA is clear, as Judge Easterbrook has pointed out, that it does not impose an affirmative duty on employers to offer maternity leave or accommodations, but only requires that the employer treat the employee as well as it would have treated her if she were not pregnant. And that's precisely what occurred here. Beverly had a long-standing policy. Coincidentally, it was the same policy that was upheld by the 11th Circuit in the Spivey case, relying on the 7th Circuit's decision in Troop. In fact, the circuits that have decided this precise issue, the 11th Circuit, the 5th Circuit, and the 6th Circuit, and particularly the 5th and the 11th Circuit, have relied on this circuit's decision in Troop to support its conclusion that a policy such as Beverly had was consistent with the PDA. The district court properly found that Beverly's policy was pregnancy blind. It treated Ms. Seredny precisely the same as it would have treated the employee who sustained some type of off-the-job situation that prevented them or him or her from performing the duties of the job. And for the PDA, I think it's important to point out it is a different kind of statute than the ADA. And you don't focus in, for purposes of the PDA, on the essential functions of the job. It is all of the required duties of the job. And it is important, I think, to note and of significance that in this case, it was the plaintiff herself who went to her doctor, who described the duties of her job, what she was required to do, and described them to her doctor. And it was based on her description of the requirements and duties of her job that the doctor said that she needed some type of modified duty for a limited period of time. It was not the employer who suggested this. It was she had announced that she was pregnant a couple months before she brought in the doctor's note, and there was not any issue whatsoever. It's undisputed in the record with respect to how she was treated. She was permitted to return to work. There was not any issue of any kind or nature simply because she was pregnant. It was only when she requested, based on her description of her job to her doctor, that she couldn't perform the full array of her duties that the policy that was longstanding was applied to her.
I think your brief made your position abundantly clear.
I would agree. I mean,
In which case?
I'm sorry?
I say, in which case? You intend to elaborate on the brief? Or you?
Well, I'll be glad to do that. I do think that all of the points that my opponent raised are adequately addressed in our brief. I think there are just a couple points, perhaps, if I may be helpful to the court, if you would like for me to address a couple of specific points that she had raised in the oral argument. And it may be more productive, because I do agree that our points are addressed in our brief. The citation to Bragdon versus Abbott, the Supreme Court decision that she raised, that was a situation where the plaintiff, the ability to bear children itself was imposed. That was the, for ADA purposes, the major life activity. And that was a permanent situation. If I recall the facts, the female plaintiff in that case had AIDS, and it was her ability to bear children that was a long-term permanent type of situation because of her medical condition. In this situation, the facts are completely different, and Bragdon has absolutely no application whatsoever to this case. In this case, the complications or purported complications not only went away after the delivery, and as the court has noted, she did deliver not only the child at issue in this case or the pregnancy at issue in this case, but also during the course of this litigation became pregnant again without any complications, without any restrictions whatsoever during that pregnancy, and thank goodness delivered a healthy child.
Mother and child are both doing fine at this stage of the proceeding.
As far as I know. So there is no long-term impact. I mean, the cases in Troop and the other cases in this circuit where a female plaintiff has suffered common types of temporary situations during a pregnancy, morning sickness and the like, have all been regarded as non-disability types of situations for which an accommodation under the ADA is not required. I think our brief...
So, Mr. Glassman, in your thought then is that pregnancy in itself, without other than normal complications, morning sickness, would never be a disability.
It's not only my opinion. I think that's what the cases say in the EEOC regulation, that pregnancy in itself is never a disability. I think with respect to the purported individuals who Beverly purportedly treated differently, I think our brief does address that. I think
how can pregnancy never be a disability? EEOC's regulation, as I understand it, suggests, doesn't really establish, but it hints at a six-month line. Can't you imagine places, particular workplaces, where it would be imprudent for any pregnant person to be? I mean, think about places that have elevated levels of lead.
Where is such a case? I wrote it.
There is a case where an employer, the name escapes me for the moment, but I do recall the facts.
The Wisconsin case and was reversed by the Supreme Court.
Yes, and the employer is not in a position to take that paternalistic type of approach. That was determined to be a violation of Title VII.
All right, so you don't want to say that it's impossible for pregnancy to be a disability for purposes of the ADA. I think you just want to say that it wasn't established that it was a disability here.
Well, that's certainly the case. The latter. We can
don't
perhaps.
Take on the whole world.
great advice. And with respect to the comparators, our brief addresses those. I think in many cases they are the evidence with respect to those is not admissible. It's hearsay. Our brief addresses that, and I think Judge Miller's opinion and addresses those. And I understand this is a de novo review, but I think his opinion is extremely thorough, extremely detailed on those particular points in particular, that why purported comparators are not, in fact, comparators, or certain evidence with respect to purported comparators is not even admissible. With respect to this issue, and it's in the appellant's brief as well as to the claim that the plaintiff had paid time off left when her employment ended, there is nothing in the record that establishes that or suggests that. In fact, the record is undisputed to the contrary. At page 486 of the record establishes that she, at the time her employment ended, she had in fact been paid all and taken and used up all of the paid time to which she had been entitled. And these claims, there is absolutely no support in the record for that whatsoever. There is no evidence of retaliation or pretext in this case, because it is undisputed that the reason that the employment ended is because of the application of this particular policy. And that had the plaintiff herself had conceded had been a long-established policy and was not put in place just simply to apply to her. She was treated the same under that policy as the company had treated every other individual who had an inability to perform their duties of the job. I'd be glad to answer any questions that the court has. I know I have time left, but I understand that. I think we have adequately addressed it. And with due respect, I don't think anything that my opponent raised in the oral argument is not addressed in our brief adequately and in Judge Miller's opinion. But I would be glad to address any questions that the court may have. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Glassman. Anything further, Ms. Hearn?
I believe the bottom line is that Mr. Rudney was fired when she could perform the essential functions of her job. This court would look at her job essential qualifications. It was in her job requirements. There was nothing regarding lifting, nothing in her that for the reason she was fired for. So for them to fire her for not doing something that was not contained in her job description, I think that in itself is a violation of the Pregnancy Discrimination Act. We are not talking about morning sickness here. We are talking about shearing of the uterus. Her cervix was thinning. She had a prior miscarriage. And what the doctor said in her in the records that are before this court, that she had a threatened abortion of her current pregnancy. This is a lot more than the minimal morning sicknesses, some swelling of the feet women would have during their pregnancies. She was cramping. She was spotting. It was not only did they, if she doesn't even fall under a disability under the ADA, they also regarded her as being disabled. She did have paid time off. If you look at the record in Appendix 524, 626 to 627, 570, 584, 632 to 633, and 709 to 715, HR Rep. Barnett testified Victoria still had 8 days of paid vacation left. They fired her before her paid vacation expired. She was retaliated. They started writing her up after she asked for an accommodation, for messy office, that she was disorganized. If they weren't thinking of reasons to fire her, I'm sorry, I'm out of time, but we just ask that summary judgment be reversed. Thank you.
Case is taken under advisement.